there. So that does that. And we're in the process of having a quiz. So welcome to our third lesson in the Christian worldview. I'll go back and put the title slide on here so we'll have remember where we are here on the planet with stars twinkling. But I want everybody to take a few minutes, just a minute or two, and work on this quiz. There are three elements, kind of they're the three nouns, if you will, and then the three processes that describe relationships between these. So those form the six fundamental principles that we're using to kind of look at each of these issues that come out of our Christian worldview. And I learned from Dave Hamlet on Saturday that you can break people into groups, and I'm prepared to do that. So if you want to work in groups on the quiz, we can do that. Other than that, I'm not sure I have a good reason to do that in this session, but I'll think of one just to show off it. So work on the quiz, please. And I'm going to mute everybody for now. And then unmute everybody when we go and answer the quiz. So we're going to go 30 seconds here. And I'll remind you while you're on mute that there are specific words. So it's not just putting God up in the square. There are two descriptors of that are kind of very essential. The wording is very important in each of these, and they all have a specific meaning. Okay, everybody's unmuted. Let's go on the quiz here. What goes in this top square? What is the centerpiece, really, in the beginning of everything about the Christian worldview that goes in here?
Personal infinite God.
Personal infinite God, that's right. Not impersonal infinite, not personal and finite, but a personal infinite God, meaning that he thinks and plans, has reason, can communicate, has emotion, expresses love, makes plans, brings them about, and so on. Now, what goes in the second box? Now, that's below a line. We'll talk about what that line means again in a minute. What's here? What goes in this box?
Spiritual man.
Spiritual man. Which means that he is part of nature, but he has an aspect of his being, an element that is in common with this personal God above. Now, what about down below? What's the third layer here if we're going to talk about it?
Fallen world.
Fallen world. And you can think of it as the world of nature. Fallen is important. It relates really to the spiritual nature of man, but it also, for us as Christians, helps us understand the imperfection in the world and also gives us a reason, really, a motivation to hope for a final resolution. And Christians, of course, have that answer as well. We'll get to that in a minute. All right, what's this first blue box that has to do with the interaction between the personal infinite God and spiritual man?
Propositional revelation.
Great. Thanks, Teresa. The propositional revelation, meaning that it isn't just a feeling. It isn't a nonverbal thing. It's not a simple intuition. It's not just emotion. It actually has words, and those words carry content. The content's independent of the sender and the receiver. It can actually be transferred from man to man, and it is expressed in written form for the most part and over time. So that's the God that Christians believe in. And then there's another example of that interaction between this infinite spiritual only being and finite but spiritual man. What's that other thing here in this box?
Jesus came,
and that's, there's a bigger story than those two words, but the idea is that it's a God expressing and demonstrating himself in the form of man, taking on the nature of man, but also a part of a larger purpose of solving this problem, which is described by the spiritual man who has accountability and the fallen world in which we live. And so what's the final thing that goes in last box? It's an interaction between this infinite God and this finite world.
Judgment.
It's judgment. And it's really, it expresses the fact that the down below that line there is a temporal world that will end. But it doesn't just end. It comes to an end with a resolution, solving the problem of the fallen world and the spiritual separation of man. And we'll talk some more about that. So I'm gonna draw another picture of it. Again, remember, we drew these lines, and what is it that that we have in common with the fallen world that we don't have in common with God? You remember these words that go down this left-hand side?
We are physical and finite.
Yes, that's correct. And God is supernatural or spiritual and infinite, if you want to say it that way. On the other hand, we can draw the line differently here. We have something in common with God, but we do not have in common with nature, the rest of the created world, the rest of the finite world. What goes here?
Is that for, you mean for our ability to reason? Or?
Yes, in the image of God, those kind of ideas, you're right. That's the personal, and this is the spiritual and personal, and then there's the impersonal for the world. I know these just, when I look at this, I'm thinking, well, everybody knows that. This is nothing new. But do you realize that that is not what most of the world believes? And in a world of intellectuals and science, the thought that somehow man is not really the same substance in every way as the natural world, the deterministic, following natural laws, that's an idea that's not accepted much anymore. It was for a long time in Western civilization, I think, and probably is in some measure, maybe in most parts of the world. But in our Western civilization, a culture, in our modern, so-called modern world and postmodern world, that's really not accepted, at least in a rational, sometimes irrational way. Okay, I'm muting everybody because I'm about to start lecturing. So this lesson is really about the relationship between these top two areas here, between man and God. And I think it's the case that, you know, man and God have something in common, but it leads us to question, if we hadn't read the Bible and didn't know for sure, sorry, I have to admit a couple of people here. It leads us to wonder or to question, if I hadn't read the Bible, I wonder if God would ever interfere in the natural world. Would he speak to man? If he did, would man understand it? Would it be so frightening that it would just be counterproductive for God to speak to man? At the same time, I wonder if man could discover anything about God just on his own, like groping after him is a phrase that we'll see in just a minute, just to see if he could think about God. Would he even have ideas about God apart from a propositional revelation to say, well, there must be one, and maybe I can assume some things or discover some things about him. So the lesson today, those are the three things. We're going to call this man and the supernatural. That's the lesson. So it deals with the relationship between God and that the story up above. I just want to share with you an email I got Saturday. And this is from a person. I'll try to keep from explaining that it's a woman, but anyway, it was a person, right? And I work with her exactly one day every year. Every year she comes in and we co-teach a half of a day in a course at Georgia Tech. And other than that, I don't really know much about her. And we're always in a rush, and it's on TV. I mean, it's a remote learning thing, so it's a lot of anxiety. Anyway, I got this email, and I just wants to there's an invitation, it said an invitation to special meditation for healing and rejuvenation. She's going to use Zoom as well, just like us. So, since many of us were not able to connect to last week's meditation due to Zoom technology issues. By the way, I didn't even know about last week, so I don't know what happened there. But I hope you can join us and so on. Feel free to share with others who might be in need of a moment of peace. Join a healing and rejuvenation visualization meditation. All right. And so here it is, meditation. So we're separated and isolated physically, but we can still connect energetically and spiritually. All right. Now is the perfect opportunity to come together and treat ourselves and our community to healing and rejuvenation meditation. Join us Thursday. Free meditation facilitated by this person and co-hosted by Phoenix and Dragon Spirituality Center. Everyone's invited as we optimize our healing, strengthen our resilience, release our fears, and radiate our light. Connecting to community during this challenging time is crucial. Together as heart-centered individuals, let's navigate the unknown and shine our collective light on the path toward healing. I look forward to seeing you and your guests Thursday, etc. So, and then, of course, that's her name, and then this kind of tagline, supporting individuals to live a fulfilled and inspired life. Now, I'm going to unmute everybody. Do you see some religious references in this? Do you notice some things that kind of sound like they're somewhat religious? What do you see?
Radiate our light.
Yeah, there's just some sense of interacting with one another, and I assume that if you wouldn't want to radiate darkness, that would be bad or evil or maybe counterproductive somehow. What else?
Spirituality.
Sorry, say again.
Connect spiritually.
Yeah, connect energetically and spiritually. It's almost as if, I don't know if those are two different things, but there's some energy maybe that exists because we're connected. Obviously, it's a figurative energy, because you're not physically connected. But then there's a spiritually, and I wonder what that means. I wonder what that means. And you're free to comment. I have no idea what this is about. It was just as surprised to get as anything. But I thought, well, that kind of fits my lesson. What else? What are you seeing there? You seeing things about people who need peace, perhaps, and healing and rejuvenation, which sounds to me like a kind of a rebirth or starting over or, healing something that's wrong with us. And it's obviously not healing the COVID virus. It's something else. It's healing some other problem that we have, I guess, is the idea.
Perfect opportunity.
There's what?
Perfect opportunity to come together.
Yeah.
Treat ourselves and our community to heal.
Yeah. And do you see
about an inspired life at the bottom?
An inspired, yes. And that word inspired, of course, literally means breathed into, but it is a religious word for the most part, although it's often kind of transferred into the realm of the non-religious to say this person had some help in creativity or in something, they were inspired in that way. I mean, I think, too, the activity of meditation, doesn't that sound a little like borrowing from maybe a religious practice of some kind. So,
I mean, yeah, Marty, it just seems sort of what the world might think is good about religion.
Yes.
Peace and harmony,
healing and making your life worthy, inspired, you might say, or at least fulfilled. So you have meaning in life. You have something to hold on to in a time of uncertainty, right? You get a peace, and if you're feeling down, you're rejuvenated and energy flows in and all that. So you have a fellowship, although that word's not in here. That's kind of the implication. Let's all be connected energy, and this energy is going to flow back and forth.
They're trying to gain the benefits of being religious without having God.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I wonder if I joined and said, well, I actually believe that there's only one God, and it's the God that's described in the Bible, the Jehovah of the Old Testament, and that his son Jesus really is the only way for us to have any of the benefits of religion. You think that would go over very well in this session? Let me ask the question a different way. How many people who got this email were likely to respond and say, I don't think this makes any sense? This is just content-free words. How many people do you think responded that way to her email?
I would argue probably people didn't really respond at all. I would imagine. Just quite frank.
Well, you don't think anybody's going to show up for the meditation session, Sean? Is that, what are you saying?
I mean, just looking at the idea of being heart-centered individuals, I think that kind of implies it's something subjective, like whose heart are we measuring it by? Because if it's heart-centered, then it seems like it's more if it's individual, then are we measuring to each other's standards? And I mean, just kind of looking at this language, like if I were in school now and I heard someone say this, or even some of my people my age, you probably either just ignore it completely or maybe ridicule it. Just with all due respect to the individual, it just seems kind of wish-wash, I guess, for the lack of a better term.
Okay. I don't want to spend too much more time, but I'm really fascinated by your answer. Is that because you're Sham and you know better, or is it because all people your age would see this as fluff without content? And I don't know this answer. I'm asking you genuinely. Santi, you're free to weigh in on this too, being having an Eastern religion background kind of or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to comment next, but yeah, if Sham has something to say.
Yeah.
I mean, the only thing I can really think of is, I mean, part of it's personal just because of my background, but I mean, just from, I guess, personal experience more anything, like, people just want to do their own thing at the end of the day. And if they're just effectively telling us, let's do our own thing, but together, then why would I need to participate in some kind of meditation session when I can do that on my own?
Okay, I still can't tell if I'm talking to Sham or if I'm talking to a typical 20-something. I can't tell.
Meredith was saying that this kind of language is very common on Facebook in the mom groups that she's a part of.
Yeah, and I'll bet the moms don't criticize one another when they use this kind of language, do they? And Santi, what are you going to say?
So I see the words Phoenix and Dragon Spirituality Center. So I think it clearly alludes to an East Asian feng shui or a practice that kind of promotes the life force or the qi, as they call it, in East Asian religions. So I think it has a certain appeal towards tackling social anxiety and fears of that sort, given the current circumstances.
What is the appeal? Let me just break in and finish. But what's the appeal? What is the certain appeal? Just a sense of peace or some kind of a...
So I think it's more towards bringing out the positive attitudes or positivity in you and surround you with those ideas to kind of evoke a sense of calm and quiet in you.
Marty, I would have the question, what qualifies this person to be the leader of this spiritual healing or whatever? Do you know?
No, I don't really have any idea. I mean, I'm surprised that, like I say, we're always in a rush to get on the camera and get off, and she leaves before I'm finished, so I don't really know her very well at all. I'm kind of surprised by it. No, I don't know, but that raises another question, and that is there some path or training or content of any kind that's required to be a part of this? I don't really know. Okay, that's enough on this, but I just want to make the point that do you see that there's a religious flavor to this? It's almost as if there's a desire to be religious and get, as Danny said very well, to get some of the benefits of religion, but there's no content here. And the other thing I wanted to point out from this is I'm pretty sure that no one responded and said, there's no content here. I don't know what this is about. They just, I mean, it's kind of one of those, okay, great, that's great for her to do and whoever else joins in. Do you think there would be any criticism of what they were doing? I mean, Sham's, I don't know if it's Sham or the 20-something that he was representing, but he would kind of blow it off just fluffy. And I'm the same way, but I'm not sure I'm a credible sample of society. But I do think that I don't think she would be expecting much criticism, about this. So let's be a little bit more specific. You remember the T-shirt lady? You remember she made a reference to religion a couple of times, and I've put some of that here on the screen. We tried to estimate what her views toward religion would be. Do you think she would be against all religions? Remember the T-shirt lady on the airplane? Okay, Ryan, you say no. Why not?
Because she has facets of religion in the things that she says and has some go ahead.
She has respect for the religions that are changing to match the culture around her.
Yeah, she's very favorable toward that. But there was, she was very critical of some aspects of religion. What were the ones that she was very critical about?
The things that she would say hold back the progress of the nation, such as allowing things that are not hurting other things.
Right. That is, they don't change with the times, right? They don't learn as man learns, as science advances, as sociology discovers, as civilization and culture change, they don't adapt. That's one thing. I think is, so I've called up a couple of things. She mentions, you know, about her personal values, right and wrong, and whether that's rooted in some kind of a faith system or not. She's accepting or at least encouraging everyone to have his or her own beliefs, right? So, but it's not based on any revelation. It's based on what they've experienced. It's a man-centric type of thing. And by the way, I'm not just inventing these straw people, to bash them. I think you have to agree, these are our neighbors. These are the teachers in our universities, right? These are the media stars. This is the culture. This is what's behind the movies, the plot lines, and the value systems that are in our entertainment system. I hope you see that. Anyway, we'll go on to show a couple other things. Her real criticism was when someone would take religion and hide behind it in order to condemn other people and just do what they personally wanted to believe and claim that was some religious conviction and everybody else had to go with what they believed. That was one thing. And she says this, religion would be okay if you keep it to yourself. You see the important element there? What does keep it to yourself mean? What does that mean?
Don't push your beliefs off on everyone else.
Yeah, exactly. And don't judge them in some sense, meaning that say they were wrong, I guess would be the way she'd say that. And finally, you know, here's the real indictment of organized religion is that they often invent a set of laws, force other people to follow them, and condemn everybody who doesn't believe and act like they do. Has that ever really happened? Has a religion made up a bunch of laws and made people do it or punished them or persecuted them because they didn't? Has that ever happened in the whole world? Yes, it has. Of course it has. And so that, you know, maybe that's a fair indictment. From her point of view, it probably is, but that's certainly the case. Okay. And then I'm just going to keep bashing on this point, even though we're maybe almost halfway done, but I still think that, looking at these fundamental principles of the worldview make more sense in contrast to what most people believe and teach in our culture today. Here's a thing that you'll hear over and over, especially in the media. I really like the church where I go because it's open to all kinds of beliefs and worship forms. Isn't that the ideal church nowadays? In fact, I guess there's kind of like universalists that kind of make a huge point of never saying anything absolute or coming to a conclusion. It's a safe place. Now, you understand safe is a kind of a special word nowadays. It means safe from criticism, safe from anything that would bring out negativity or make me feel bad or make me feel like I've got something wrong with me. It's a safe place where people can follow their own conscience to find God in their own way, and everyone's striving to make the world better. You see, the key idea often in religion is it has a purpose, but it's not a spiritual one. It really aims more at fixing problems in this world as if they could be perfected somehow someday. And then I think this is a typical point of view, at least in the academic world, about the Bible and Judeo-Christian traditions. They're just one of the many ways, and certainly we would be criticized to ever believe that we're the only way. They're one of many ways that man has sought to make sense of a frightening and uncertain world. People who adopt these traditions can achieve a measure of peace, and there, Danny's point about getting the benefits of, by connecting to past generations while reaching out for God. So you see, it's kind of a tradition that I have a heritage. I'm a Jewish person and I have the whole history. It was interesting to hear about the, you know, the Passover celebration, and it's all really a oneness with those poor, they were calling them Jews who came out of Egypt. I don't think that's quite the right way to say it, but you know, they came out of Egypt. And so now we're today trying to escape out the slavery of this virus, for example. So the tradition has some value and meaning to us, but also this way of searching for God and making some sense out of the world. And so I remember as a kid, I felt like a kid for sure, I was visiting Foy Short. And Sewell, is it Margaret? Is that boy's wife. Is that right?
Yes.
Margaret.
Yes.
Yeah. So Margaret worked with this guy, and he was a student, and he was kind of interested in theology and stuff. And I was like 20-something, and I guess Shom's age. I don't know. But anyway, I was there traveling with my dad in Rhodesia and at the time. And this guy said, yeah, so she said, you really got to talk to this guy. So I went and talked to him. He was an intellectual type guy. And he said, yeah, here's the way religions are. There's God, and then all around there are these stained glass windows that you can't really see through very clearly. They're different colors, and they distort the light, and there's all kinds of, you know, strange reflections and everything. And so every religion and every philosophy and every superstition and even cults are all looking in at the same God from different points of view. You know, and they all are seeing a different picture, but it's really all the same God. They're all just doing their best to try to figure out what God is. That was his picture. And so then he said, okay, what do you think of that? And so I'm sure I said something like, but anyway, that was kind of I believe he was describing what most people's view of religion is. Here's another way to draw the same thing. Let's put God in this spiritual, you know, supernatural realm, not physical. And here's man down here below that in nature. And somehow we or another, we suspect that there's something up there. In fact, not only we suspect that, we really wish there was, because left to our own world and nature and laws of physics, that if we begin to believe that's all there is in the world, there is meaninglessness. There is no source of peace. There is no kind of a sense of purpose or anything like that. And so that's part of the Schaefer story and all that. So what happens is man then begins in various ways to try to find God, and, you know, misses the mark and gets all twisted up and confused and everything. Can you think of a Bible passage that talks about man groping for God like that as part of the way, maybe the way God intended for him to act? Can you think of one?
Acts 17.
Yeah, Paul's sermon. That's exactly, let me see if I can go ahead of this one right here. Look at Acts 17. I believe that Paul implied that God made man in such a way that's what he does. He's kind of naturally inclined to seek and grope around to see if he can find God. And so, verse 26, he's made, from one of all, men to dwell on the earth so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him. He made us in the way so that we are searching for something more spiritual. Now, in the absence of a belief in any propositional revelation, you're going to get an email that just says, we're going to all join together and try to feel God somehow by meditating and be rejuvenated somehow or something like that. But it has no content. And obviously, if it has no content and it's just subjective, then you really can't criticize or even understand what somebody else might believe. So here are some example issues that we'll talk about. And I don't think it'll take as long to go through this sequence of logic tonight, but I just wanted to emphasize what a different world we live in from the Christian worldview. Here are some example issues, and these are listed in the lesson material, and they're in Part A, but I reorganized them and reworded them a little bit because I thought I updated them, is maybe a better way to say it. So I'm going to mute you, but you can take yourself off mute and break in, and please do if you want to. One, to start with this, and these are not all the same belief. They're variations, I think, but anyway, all religions, which all have different beliefs and practices, are equally valid attempts to find God. And that's the stained glass window and the swirly lines reaching up to God. And so any religious activity, all of them practiced in sincere devotion, are equally valid, except for one, and that's if people think they're exclusively true. Then they're not valid. Which seems like an absolute statement to say that, but that's that self-contradictory problem that you have when there are no absolutes. And then the second sub-bullet here is the religious experience is personal. I mean, what else would you build it on, right? It's personally determined, it's private, and it's subjective. Subjective means it's just based on what I feel about it, the way I look at it, not the way you look at it, but the way I look at it, which is different. and therefore it's difficult to communicate or transfer this to any other person. Here's another point of view. Number two, maybe as a result of number one, but religion is optional and it shouldn't be forced upon anyone. Isn't that a view of our world today? This is not a crazy. God is in nature and he's in all of us. He or she, of course, is the life force of the universe. That's God. You know people who believe that? Does anybody know someone who? So they're kind of in us. I feel it. That's how I know. Or I see it in the majesty of the universe, but that's as much as I know. Similarly, God or God thoughts are the problem of human desires and imagination and help people when they're frightened or discouraged. And you'll often hear this story, I guess, in anthropology and psychology, and that is, well, there were these cavemen, and they were not as smart as we are, of course, and they saw lightning and storms and wind, and every once in a while the moon would kind of get small and then it'd get big again and get cold, and it scared them. And so the only way they could explain it was to invent supernatural beings who controlled all those things, the sun, lightning, and other things. And so that's really where God came from.
Hey, Marty?
Yes, yes, Wayne.
So just based on one and two, I think it could probably be true for the rest. The assumption here with these are that religions really come from man's attempt to find God, and it's based in man's reality. Right. And so therefore, if I'm an individual, I shouldn't force that on someone else because my belief understanding should be equally valid.
Right. I think that's exactly right. And I hope you remember this picture, this one right here, because that really is the picture of religion generally, right? I mean, if I live in Africa, I might be trying one thing and I have these other traditions and other things. And these are all just various multicolored ways of finding God. And I mean, there's all kind of questions that you want to ask. Okay, well, why are we looking for God again? What is it? Where did that come from? Why is that in me? Why do I have that desire? And why would I have thought of gods as the explanation for thunder and lightning? I mean, where did that idea? I mean, you could argue that, okay, maybe that's where all religion came from, but where did that idea come from? I mean, where there was a sense of some super person bigger than me and who controlled all of the world and nature. Where did that idea come from? I mean, there's a kind of a first cause argument here in a way. But yes, Wayne's point is exactly right. So yes, God thoughts are the product of human desires and imagination, and they help people. Now, all people, including Christian religion, should just work to benefit mankind. And that's the kind of non-spiritual view. Religious groups need to evolve their activities to meet the needs and desires of each age and culture. And then this is a little bit of an oddball argument, but it's the totally other argument, which is, okay, God, yes, if there is a God, he's out there, he's totally spiritual. Man is totally physical. So how could we ever know anything about God? It'd be like a fish trying to understand air-breathing animals. They've never experienced one another, and they don't really understand that. And, of course, as a Christian, you can kind of think of the answers for each of these, and that's what we're going to talk about in the lesson here. Okay. All right. I've tried to just set the stage of what I believe most of the world believes, some version of some of these things. So you're welcome to break in and add to or object or ask questions about that. So let's start. And again, I'm following these. If you look at the lesson three, which the material is on the website, I'm following these questions 1 through 10, and that's gonna show up on this page right here. So you can fill it in if you want to go and take notes. Okay, question one was who was created in whose image, right? Is man created in the image of God, or is God created in the image of man? This is kind of like a foundational point to start with, to really exactly to Wayne's point, right? Is God a creation of man? Does he start with himself, or does it kind of work the other way around? How did it all begin? And of course, in the Bible picture, God said, "Let us make man in our image." It's not the other way around. And if you think about the Bible descriptions, say in Isaiah, about the fellow that makes his own gods, right? What's it's almost like a silly picture. If I remember, I can't remember if that was in the Psalms or in Isaiah, where he cooks his food and he does other stuff with the same wood, but then out of that, with his own creativity, he carves something, and I mean, it's so wobbly, he has to prop it up, but still, he's going to still believe that's his God and so on. And so this idea of creating God in man's image is pervasive. In fact, that's what idolatry is at its root. And what the advantage of that is when you make the idols, they don't talk to you, right? They don't tell you what to do. They don't condemn you. And if they do talk, it's ventriloquism. They say what you want them to say, right? And that's kind of the nature. Since I'm making it up, they just say what I want them to say. I think in contrast to what Habakkuk said, or what God told Habakkuk, or in that poem, and he said, the Lord is in his holy temple, let all the earth keep silence before him. That is, let's listen instead of talking. Okay, so this is not a surprise. So start with that. It doesn't actually answer the question, okay, well then how do I know about God? How do I know how to worship him? What does he expect? What is his plan for me? And how should he govern me? And then, of course, the other thing is to recognize that other line down below, and that is we are not trapped in the non-human world, in the natural world of laws. There's a dominion that God made for man to have over the created things. There's something superior, something special. It may be analogous to the God-man relationship is the man and nature relationship. Now, we understand the world has fallen, and yet God's elevated man to almost to be like an angel. Is that what he says in Psalm 8? Just a little lower than the angels in some way compared to the natural world. Put all things dominion under him. So we might maybe could understand the relationship between God and man by looking a little bit at the fact that we are not trapped in the deterministic world of nature. We exist outside that and have a sense of free will and can plan and reason in a way that the animals can't and the other parts of the natural world do not. Okay, now I'm down to question number 3. What part of man is more permanent? Is it the spiritual component or the physical component? I think this is kind of important. Because if I think of man as primarily or solely physical, then the whole relationship with God question doesn't make a lot of sense. It's maybe not even relevant. But if I do have a spiritual component, then that relationship with God does matter. Just a couple of passages. 1 Corinthians 15, Paul, again, in the chapter related to resurrection, really, is, I say, brethren, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God. That's an interesting thing. And that is, my flesh and blood almost has to fall away and leave the valuable thing, the unseen thing, the spiritual element, as finalizing that relationship with God, being part of his final kingdom. And he says, verse 51, we'll all be changed. And he describes on about mortality, putting on immortality there in 1 Corinthians 15. So to kind of look at it this way, with regard to personality or, you know, personhood or whatever, you've got God and man more alike. And then, of course, with regard to finiteness, man and nature are more alike. That's just what we've talked about. But we should think of man and God as in some ways more compatible than man and nature with regard to these spiritual questions. And so it seemed to me a terrible solution to put God down in the world of nature and make nature into God. It seemed like that's like the silliest thing of all from the Christian worldview. But on the other hand, God's power and deity can be seen in nature. They're a reflection of God's glory. They're not God, but because of what God has done through that work, the works of his hands, his handiwork, I think the psalm says, you can see some things about him. And so you can see his power and you can see his divinity or divine nature. You can see his glory or praiseworthiness, his testedness, if you listened to that sermon not too long ago, and also his cleverness, his the brilliance of his handiwork as well. These are all things we can know about God. Now, does that tell us how to worship him? Does it explain how we got here? Does it really say much about man's nature being in the image of God? Does it describe what will happen at the end of time? Does it explain why I feel guilty? Does it explain what I should do about my guilt? Or what will happen to me if I don't find a solution? None of those things, but it does say that there is a being that I should perhaps long for and maybe have a good bit in common with, as some of your own poets have said, for we are his offspring. That's why we're interested in God, because we actually, we're in a way his children. And so it's clear that we would see some things about him and we might actually long then to understand more about him. And so there are lots of ways I can try to learn about God. I can observe the world and see his power and divinity. I can listen to other men who have thought for a long time about right and wrong, about universal truth, about the value of man, about a lot of things. Maybe they can discover a little bit more about themselves, maybe even about God. But the real source, don't you see, has to come from a direct revelation from God, given his great superiority to our ability to know. I don't think I'm saying anything that's surprising, but I hope you see this in contrast to what most people believe. So this is maybe I could go back to that one last picture there. One question would be, does God ever penetrate through this barrier that separates the supernatural and the natural world? Does God ever intervene in that world? And you realize that lots of folks would think that he doesn't. And I'm not quite sure if they just think he doesn't because he doesn't want to, or that he isn't able, or they're hoping he won't. I don't really know what the reasons are, but I think it's often the case we just think, no, we're in a closed world. If God made it, that's great, but he just kind of left us alone to figure things out for ourselves. But to me, that's the least logical thought, given that I see in the creation an enormously great mind and wisdom behind it, to think that, well, I don't. But after he created, he just left it. He didn't really explain anything, sent it off. I believe this may be a Sewell illustration. I don't know, but that Voyager satellite that they launched, and it somehow escaped the solar system. It's out there floating, you know, off towards some outer space point. You probably know what I'm talking about. I think it was launched back in the 70s or something. It's been gone for a long time. If someone discovered that, it would be interesting. They could look at it and say, well, there must have been some purpose for this. What, this is not a natural thing, you know, as they would think. And I wonder if we're not sitting here in the world looking at ourselves, our conscience, and we're looking at the beauty of creation and, for some of us, the mathematics behind it, and saying, well, there's got to be some purpose behind it. And whoever was smart enough to make this world down here seemed like would not have any trouble entering into it, either with words or even with actions. So that's the point of this next one. God does act miraculously and non-miraculously in the natural world. And I think that was kind of one of the tenets of the false teachers in that Second Peter was written to address. And that is, things just continue on as they have from the beginning, and God never messes with this world. He just leaves it alone. And Peter's argument, based on Old Testament history, was no, actually think about it. Even in the supernatural world, God takes action. He doesn't spare angels that sin. He preserved Noah. He did not spare the sinful ancient world, but sent the flood. He burned up Sodom and Gomorrah. He rescued righteous Lot. And if he can do all that, or has done all that, then he can rescue the godly from trials and keep the unrighteous under punishment till the day of judgment. There'll be a resolution someday, so don't start to think that's not the case. And then second, in the next chapter, really specifically addressing this kind of, I forget there's a name for that, uniformitarianism, I think. Is that right? Where things never change, they go on forever and ever, they're never interfered with. But nope, that doesn't work either. First of all, there was this great non-linear event, you might want to call it this kind of great interaction, which ended up being the creation. Well, there's a huge discontinuity there. There was nothing, and then there's something. So that, I mean, start with that as kind of a proof that, no, it's not quite a uniform process. But then in addition, he mentions the flood and reasons from that there might be even a larger destruction, discontinuity in the future that will come with the final destruction of things by fire and the destruction of the ungodly associated with that judgment. So we could say more about that. Notice then the tenets of the scoffers is that all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. This revelation that especially Peter describes here says that's not the case, that God does interact with the natural world, both in miraculous and non-miraculous ways. Not only that, but he has, and this is kind of the key point, he has communicated his nature and his will for man through propositional revelation. And that's really basically the fourth fundamental principle. And we've, I think, looked at these very verses. God, who in various ways spoke in time past to the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by his Son. And that's our fifth propositional, our fifth foundation principle. And of course, John 1, the Word became flesh. We beheld his glory. We could see it. Later, John will say that we touched and handled, and there was a physical manifestation of God in the flesh. No one has seen God, but the only begotten Son who's in the bosom of the Father has declared him. And so we've had that opportunity to learn about God through the coming of Christ. And then this passage from 1 Corinthians 2, where Paul is describing the source of his revelation. God's revealed these things, which you would have never figured out. Eye hasn't seen it, ear hasn't heard it, hasn't entered into our heart. So back to Wayne's point, it's not in our heart. You can search your heart all you want to, it's just not there. It never got there. You have to have some external source of that information. These things that God's prepared, but God's revealed them through the Spirit that we might know the things that have been freely given to us by God. That's 1 Corinthians 2. So these are not surprises, but understand the Christian view is very different from what we saw earlier. So God not only acts in the course of history in miraculous ways as non-miraculous, but he also communicates, which is of the same, really the same character of an event, which is to come into the world. You can kind of see it more graphically at Mount Sinai, where God's entering in with both miracles and with revelation. Now, this is an interesting one. Again, not starting with man and trying to make God what we want him to be, or maybe even to figure out what he is from our point of view, but it's the other way around. The goal of religion is to make man more like God. That's an interesting reversal in some ways. But think about some of the ways in which the purpose of God's work is described. His divine power, I think Blaine quoted this in our first class, his divine power has given us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of him who called us by glory and virtue. You see that the things we're given have to do with learning, with propositional truth. And what's the purpose? Verse 4. You can see it. What's the purpose? There's great and precious promises, which I think include that we're partakers of the divine nature, not the other way around. God is not a partaker of our physical nature. We are to be partakers of the divine nature. John 1:12. As many as receive him, he gave the right to become children of God. You see, that's a change in us that makes us more like God on the spiritual side of things. And then the metaphor of being born again is more than just starting over. What's the seed? What is the fertilizing seed that leads to that new birth? Well, it's the Word of God. So it's not just we get to start over again as new babies. It's we actually have a different father. You know, the conception, the fertilization now comes from a seed that actually has its source in God itself. So the new birth itself is a picture, really, of man adopting or obtaining, to some extent, more of the character of God, not the other way around. That's the answer to number 7. Number 8, okay, if we have that relationship, are there things God wants us to do with regard to our communication with him? We've seen in the creation that we ought to be thankful and we ought to give glory to God, right? just because of what we see in nature. But is there some specific way in which we should do that? Are there activities, including benevolence to one another, that should flow out of this revelation, this information that comes from God that we'd never figure out on our own? Are there specific activities and methods of worship? Now, can you imagine a situation where God didn't really give us any instructions about that? Would that be a possible thing? Like just be in awe of God and understand that there'll be a judgment and do the best you can. That's possible, right? I mean, anybody want to argue with that? Blaine's nodding his head. I guess it's theoretically possible. That is not what the Bible says, and yet it is maybe a good position if you didn't have the revelation from the Bible. Just do the best you can. Be praiseworthy. Praise God because He is praiseworthy. Don't maybe follow your conscience somehow. I don't know exactly where all that would go, but in general. But fortunately, we're not left with that. We're left with more specific instructions. And really, you can see it through the history of the nation of Israel given to us as a pattern. In fact, the actual items of their worship are patterns in a couple of ways. One is they're shadows of New Testament realities, but they also are a pattern to us to say God does really care about following the pattern and following the instructions about how He wants us to worship Him very carefully. And you can see that in these verses, Exodus 24, and then kind of a reference to that in Hebrews 8. Those old priests served the copy and shadow of the heavenly things. And I wonder if our worship today might also be a shadow of a greater reality yet to come. Is that a possibility? Just like in the Old Testament, that was a shadow of the new covenant and what was to come. And I wonder if it isn't important for us to do the things that God has given us to do carefully, because they do represent a greater reality, maybe that we don't even fully understand, just like maybe Moses and the Levites and the Israelites maybe didn't fully understand the symbology of the tabernacle and all those things, and maybe the meanings of the feasts and the sacrifices at that time. I wonder if that might not even still be true in some sense today. And that carried through for hundreds of years, David to Solomon and later Hezekiah and later Josiah, all following a written, propositional description of how the worship of God was to be ordered. And so I think the clear picture that's presented to us in the Bible is that God does direct the activities and methods of worship. But then that leaves another question, and that is, well, do I have to do that, or could I substitute something else? Or maybe if I do that, could I maybe add some other things, maybe that I like to do or that seem like they would be genuine, sincere, and maybe be better suited to the culture of this time and all that. I don't really know. But, of course, what we do learn is that there are false religions that are not acceptable to God. And now I think in 8, 9, and 10, we're getting to the offensive part. It's a little bit like Paul's sermon on Mars Hill. He was doing okay. It was kind of okay. He hadn't really said anything crazy. But then he started talking about somebody judging the world, and then a resurrection that proved His power to do that, and that was it. That was the end of his speech, because he went way too far. Well, we're going too far here with regard to most what people would believe, and that is there really are false religions, and it's not just that they're wrong, they're not acceptable to God. And that men would be judged for them, I think is maybe even a stronger way to say that. You understand we have now crossed the line of being, absolutists, right, in a way, of not being tolerant in modern parlance, right? We have crossed the line now of saying that others are wrong, and the T-shirt lady would not be pleased with this, right? In fact, she wasn't, if you remember how she reacted to when we got to that part in the discussion. But that's really the case, and there's just so many, in fact, so much of the Old and the New Testament, it seems to me, are warnings about false prophets, about false gods, about erroneous practices that are evil at their heart, about even teaching about the true God that's false, that's just not correct, practices that maybe acknowledge the Jehovah or the God of the New Testament, but they're just made up by men. They have no value. And here are some. You probably know it. Start with Nadab and Abihu. That's probably not the earliest place where you could start. But Second Peter talks about just there were false prophets then among those people, but that's still true today. There will be among you. They have heresies. They're destructive. They're not just alternates, harmless alternates, valid paths, different paths to God. 2 Timothy 3 talks about having a form of godliness, but having denied its power. And I think that that denying its power has to include the departure from the revealed word, because that's kind of the emphasis, as you know, in 1 and 2 Timothy, is holding on to the word and the truth that has been revealed. That's the charge Timothy's been given to deliver and to protect. Again, 1 Timothy 4, a very similar chapter to 2 Timothy 3. Y'all remember that from our Timothy class, where there's actually a list of things that in somebody's mind wouldn't be harmful. Forbidding to marry, maybe abstaining from certain foods. Is that harmful, really? But he describes it as if it's something that's quite dangerous. And they're deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons of all things, even though on the surface they seem to be innocuous practices. And then Colossians 2, the same thing. A series of descriptions of various kinds, I think maybe different kinds of false teaching, including Judaizing teachers, maybe some type of asceticism, maybe the philosophies of the Greeks. I don't really know, but there's quite a list of different ways in which you could go wrong. You could be misguided. And these are just samples, as you probably know. So, yes, there are false religious and false religious practices. And finally, now we're really going to go over the edge here with regard to our culture, and that is Christianity really does exclude other religions. It would make our lives easier, I suppose, if it didn't. I think it would make them much more confusing as the world is pretty well confused about all these things. But there's just no getting around the fact that Christianity excludes other religions. And that's what makes it unpopular. We did cover it in Lesson 1, but it was in Lesson 1. We talked about it in Lesson 2. And that is, what is it about the Christian worldview that makes it so unpopular, that draws persecution? Is it because the people, genuine Christians, are harmful, cruel? Or no, that's not really it. It seems to me it's this very point. And that is that there's an exclusivity about it. And that just grates, I think, against the modern world. And I'm back to Wayne's point again. If I start with myself and you start with yourself, what right do I have to say anybody is not right? And I don't really. And so if that's where you start, then this idea that I'm exclusive makes me nothing but a bigot, right? Nothing but a closed-minded kind of, I'm smarter than you, holier than thou, whatever phrase you want to use. Of course, that's not what's going on, but that's the way it looks to a person who believes that religions are start with man, they're man-centric in their attempts to make God in our own image. And so we can look at a few verses about that, but I think it's pretty clear in the early evangelists who went out. Jesus himself said in John 8, "If you do not believe that I am he, you will die in your sins." That's a pretty absolute statement. And I am he means that Jesus is God, of course. Russ's sermon comes to mind, and that is this divinity of God, his being the Messiah, the chosen one of God. That's required, or else we will die in our sins. John 14, Jesus said, "No one comes to the Father except through me." There's not a bunch of different stained glass windows or doors that we can kind of explore and find any one of those paths as good as any of the others, but rather there's just the one way. And back to Paul again in Acts 17. He says, the one whom you worship without knowing. Notice, he kind of, at that point, that's a little critical, but in ignorance, I think, is one English translation of that. He got away with saying that. Like every class, the same thing happens. My VPN from work terminated, but we're okay because y'all don't need that. And he says, scolding them, you ought not to think that God can kind of fit in temples, or that you can make stuff out of gold and silver, which, by the way, he made to start with, that's going to make any difference with him. He's being critical of that. And he says, these are times of ignorance. And not only that, you better repent from that ignorance, because you will be judged. You see how he's moving toward this more exclusive picture of things. First, the reason that it doesn't make any sense what you're thinking, right? That God is like man, first of all, somehow with the same limitations. But rather, he's saying, no, you're wrong. And not only that, the time is running out for you to admit you're wrong and change to the one true path. That's Paul again. Peter, in the early preaching, nor is there salvation in any other. There's no other name under heaven given by which men must be saved. Of course, that presumes that you want to be saved, that you believe there is a lostness. I mean, you kind of have to get to that point. But once you believe there is a problem with sin or with death or whatever you think it is you want to be saved from, there's really only one path. Acts 10, now addressing for the first time Gentiles. Now, maybe the gospel needs to change because they don't have the Jewish background or whatever. But no, that's not the case. Peter says, no, in every nation, actually, whoever fears him and works righteousness is accepted by him. And Jesus is Lord of all, and he will be the judge of the living and the dead. So you get the sense of exclusivity all through the New Testament teaching. There isn't. But that is so against our culture. And it will get you persecuted to talk about that very much. So I'm going to summarize, and I was prepared to go and say more about how close to these alternate paths to finding God, even some with a Christian name about them, should we get. But I'll leave that as an exercise to for homework. I was going to ask you whether I should go to this meditation session or not that I've been invited to. If I did, under what conditions should I do that, maybe, in light of this kind of a view of things? Because I think, in the end, just coming to this truth is what we already knew that. Now the question is, so how do I live now that I know these things? What should be my association with alternate religions, right? Or with this man-centric religion, religious world that we live in? Or what should my relationship to these kind of content-free things? But anyway, I'm going to just summarize since we're a little bit over. So here's the lesson, the logic. And I'm not going through 1 through 10. I'm just going to kind of step through the way we've thought about it. First of all, man does have a spiritual component that we've talked about. And it is, to some extent, responsive to God. And it leads us to have aspirations and religious thoughts. And it probably leads us to think about maybe a God that controls the lightning if I'm a caveman. I don't know. Maybe. But still, that's in my nature. It's created within me to look for something bigger than me, some person who is like me but better, like me but bigger, who had a purpose, but I don't know what it is. But maybe he might reveal that to me. But left to my own devices, I think it's true in any culture. And even the point of my bringing that email was, even in people who are not religious at all, there still is this religious vocabulary, right? And religious activities. And as Danny said, grasping for some of the benefits that are perceived to exist in religion. Certainly adopting the language of religion, even though it doesn't mean the same thing. So that's easy to explain with a Christian worldview, because God made me that way, to search for him and to want to have some information. And so the thing is, he is totally spiritual, but he does interact with the physical world. And that's pretty clear in a lot of ways. First of all, he made the physical world. He guides history. He appoints the limits of our habitations, to use Paul's language there. There are miracles such as the resurrection, but other things, including the flood in the Old Testament as an example of judgment to come. There's revelation, propositional, of course, spoke through to the fathers through the prophets, and now through his son, and from his son through the apostles. And then finally, judgment will be the last one of those ways in which this spiritual realm, the infinite realm, interacts, comes crashing through into the natural realm. So lots of ways. That's the way God is. I know that from revelation, right? That's not something I have to determine. I know that from the account of history and validated by the miracles and revelation that came along with that, those inspired writings. So God has revealed his single, exclusive will to us, especially through the incarnation of Christ. And you know, it turns out some of these religions got some of it right, don't you think, about God? But they got some of it wrong. And it seemed like it would be a great relief. It ought to be a great relief that, oh, okay, well, that's the right answer. I don't have to keep looking anymore. I think there's often an indictment that Christians are so narrow-minded because they only look at the Bible. They don't look at other things. And I guess my answer to that is once you find the answer and you're sure it's the answer, you're really wasting time looking at other things. I don't quite know a good illustration of that, but I'm looking for the right size wrench. I'm looking for a 13 millimeter. And once I find it, I don't go trying all the other ones that don't fit, because I know that's the right one. It carries the evidence that it is the right one. It's written right on the outside. And also it works for the purpose that seems to be designed and intended for. There's an imperfection in that metaphor. I know there is. But there is, and when Jesus says, except you believe that I am he, you shall die in your sins, or there's no salvation in any other, you understand that that does kind of give me a free pass from looking at all the other religions in the world. It really does, if I'm convinced it's so. So I think that yes, thank you for breaking in. I'm getting out of control.
No, I think it was either in our Leviticus class numbers, I forget who it was, but one of the things that God said about the people when they went into the land, that you're going to see these things, don't even entertain them. You're going to see these false gods and things, don't even check it out. Right. Where, you know, today, like you were saying, you have to go and examine everything and then weigh it out. No, when you have the truth, you don't have to examine everything else.
Sure. It's not an airtight argument, but I think it's a pretty strong one. And that is that I would never finish examining everything.
Right.
There's something impossible about that, you know. And someone might argue, well, you should start with the big ones and work your way down. Well, I still don't. So the question would be, is that what God wants me to do? And again, I think the propositional revelation gives me a pass from having to do that once I've decided that there's sufficient evidence in the revelation and now what I understand about the nature of God. And it really does make sense that if I'm given this huge desire to understand myself in relation to the supernatural, that it would come in a form that's kind of like, well, here's the answer, as opposed to, no, you have to search everything, your whole life, and do the best you can to synthesize what's there. You see, that's not a very satisfactory answer to that need that God seems to have put within me. So anyway, God has revealed his single exclusive will to us. That's the Christian worldview. And of course, primarily through the incarnation of Christ and the revelation that followed. It was him revealing God to us. That's what John was saying, I think, in a way that really probably could not have. There's no superior way for the revealing, not just in the words he said, but in the record of the actions and the character that was demonstrated that we have with us. Four whole books preserved for us to know about that. Point number four in our logic is that in that will that God's revealed to us, he's also said what's acceptable. And that would include instructions for worship. He wouldn't have had to include that, but he did. And given that he did, it seems similarly, I don't have to try every other kind of worship to see if that's better or superior in some way. I'm given relief from that as well. I just have to do the thing that he said to do, with some confidence that it probably is best for me to do it that way. That there's a benefit I have because he made me, and there's a sense of purpose in my creation. Maybe I'm suiting that purpose if I just do it the way he instructed. This is so simplistic, isn't it, in our complicated world? And lastly, Christianity is exclusive. And that means other religions and religious activities are not acceptable. And that's a hard message in our culture.
Hey, Marty, to your point about continuing to search, I think about Jesus and the conversation with the apostles when he started teaching some things that were offensive to some of the folks and they left. And he looks at Peter and he says, who else will we go to? You have the words of eternal life and we believe that you are the Christ. That kind of sums it up, right? Once you found the truth.
Right.
You found the words.
To whom shall we go? Yeah, to whom shall we? John 6, right after the feeding of the 5,000. There's a lot of common sense in that as well. Well, I'm not going to go any further. If you go online, you will find some more charts about maybe how we relate with other religions, which are not exclusive, and have teaching that's not consistent. But that's more relationship man to man. In this lesson, I was just trying to talk about the relationship between man and the spiritual. I hope this isn't too trivial. Maybe the value here is to see these teachings, which we all know, to see them in light of the culture in which we live and how different they really are. Maybe that will help us when we communicate with folks like the T-shirt lady. And do you see now that in speaking with the T-shirt lady, I can't just say, well, let's just read here in the Bible what it says. You're going to have to start well before that with some sense of what man is and what God is and various models and kind of work your way to the place where the Bible has some would have some value in her eyes, if you were in kind of in an evangelistic pursuit with her.